So I guess we will get started. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming today. I'm Stacy Rasgon. I'm Bernstein's Senior Research Analyst. I cover the U.S. semiconductor and semi-cap space, and I can't express what an honor it is to have our guest here today, Haviv Eilam, the President and CEO of Texas Instruments. Now, before I start, I want to mention, if you have questions you'd like to ask during the presentation, there should be a QR code in your program. It links to our Pigeonhole forum. You can submit questions there, and we will have time for Q&A in the end. And so look, like, you know, but I go on every year at this session. TI is usually here, and I always talk about the more remarkable multi-year transition story that benefited TI, like, over the years, and they've made it look easy. They like to say that people see them as boring. I'd say this, the company and the stock and the strategy have been a little less boring lately, and I want to dig into that. So to help us understand why, it's my great pleasure to welcome Haviv. So thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Stacy, and thanks for having us.
You can all hear?
Can you hear me?
Good.
Okay,
awesome.
Good. Thank you.
Great. So Haviv, I want to start out, I think, I guess, with the Elliot in the room. So clearly, like, I don't think TI has ever had an activist involved. And maybe just to start out there, can you just to level set where we are, can you just go over what the actual baseline plan is for your capacity and CapEx investments? And then I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the letter itself and the case that they're kind of laying out and, just get whatever you can. I don't know how much you can say at this point, but, like, whatever you can say, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
No, so thanks for the question, Stacy. I definitely expected it, but I can't say a lot. So just to give you the facts, we have learned about it on Tuesday morning for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty fresh, 2 days in. We are, of course, reviewing the notes and definitely look forward to engage in a constructive dialogue with Elliot. I will say that, as always, we run the company and make decisions to support the company and the entire shareholders of the company. So that will continue to guide us moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I won't go into the details today because I think it's fair we do that with Elliot first, but I would be happy to talk about our plan.
Yes.
First, you know, we can talk about the why and then the what.
Yeah.
Provide as many details as needed, as you go through your questions.
Got it. So I guess just to level set on the current plan, let me know if I-
Okay.
If I've got it wrong. So it's $5 billion in CapEx per year from 2022 to 2026, and that was taken up from $3.5 to $5. My impression there was you're effectively reinvesting the investment tax credit in more CapEx because the depreciation guidance at the time was sort of held constant. So $5 billion through 2026, and then 2027 and beyond was 10%-15% of revenue on CapEx to support, in theory, 7%-10% revenue growth at that point. Do I have that right?
Well, let's, you know, some cases and some of the points, yes, some of the points I would like to-
Please.
Provide a little bit more detail. But first, let's think about this investment.
Yeah.
Phase.
Why, to your point?
Yes.
Because, I mean, I think by the end of it, by end of 2026, the, maybe by 2030, the revenue capacity was, I can't even remember, was supposed to support... I can't even remember the number. Was it $30 billion? Maybe it was more.
We'll talk through this, but let's talk about the why first, and the why starts with the market opportunity.
Yeah.
I think it's obvious to us that the secular growth in industrial, in automotive, is actually accelerating. Of course, sometimes tough to see when you go through a correction, and there is an inventory correction in the market, but if you put it over a trend line, it's obvious that secular growth is there, and in my opinion, accelerating-
Okay.
Inside this decade.
Because this is industrial auto. I mean, you've been pushing this. You were one of the first, I think, to-
Yeah.
Pivot toward. I mean, it's got to be 10, 15 years ago, at least, right?
Which leads me to our position. And the position of, you know, we talk always about revenue, but revenue doesn't get created, you know, just by letting the market grow. It's related to our investment and our strategy. And you're right, back in, I remember 2010, 2011, we said, hey, we are going to bias our investment, our R&D, our SG&A towards these markets with the vision that secular growth is going to come. And we have done well. I mean, I have seen the R&D machine cranking out more and more parts. We used to have one business unit building automotive parts, for example, in 2010. Each and every business unit in the company does it. And the number of product lines is more than 60 product lines. They all build automotive products. So the opportunity is very, very vast. And this is how we built a position. You create a product portfolio, you engage with customers, you invest in your sales and application team, you invest in your website, which led to a strong position of almost 75% of our revenue in 2023 in industrial and automotive. So to me, to be exposed at such a high level to, I believe, a couple of the fastest growing markets in the semiconductor industry is a good position to have. The third one, and I think we talked about it even last year, there is also a tailwind on how customers make decisions. And you know, we run an average unit price at around $0.40 or so, more or less, the market. And these decisions would be made at the lowest level of the engineering force at our customers. But today, especially in the last couple of years, we get our customers receive guidelines from their leadership teams, from their CEOs, from their CPOs about the dependability of capacity. TI is in a unique position to provide this geopolitically dependable capacity at a very affordable, cost-competitive manner, and also with a muscle or the size of the capacity. So when you think about these three elements and you say, hey, we have grown industrial and automotive between 2013 to 2023 at 10% CAGR, could we accelerate it this decade? I think we can. Hard to see right now because we are going through an inventory correction. But when I think about the next peak, this is what guides our preparation, I want to be ready to support this and our potential. And this is why we are invested in the capacity. Okay? And it's done in three phases, and I would like to go through them if you will.
Yes, please. Okay. There's a lot of different pieces here.
Yeah, and it's very complex. I can tell you that the execution of that plan is complex, and it's actually more than 3 years of an investment period. It's 6 years, started in 2021, with the acquisition of the asset from Micron, the Lehi acquisition, and working through 2022 to qualify the fab and to ramp it to production, which we have done at the end of 2022. I think I was here a year ago, and we talked about this fab is ramping to production. We have continued to do that. And I love Lehi because simply it doesn't need revenue growth to get utilized. So you think about Lehi as a transfer fab. This is where every week we have wafers moving away from TSMC, UMC into Lehi. It's done in two waves.
Is it analog then, or it's embedded?
You're starting with embedded, but analog is following. Let me start to give you some more granularity here. 2022 was really F65, we call it, or 65-nanometer embedded non-volatile memory, serving low-power MCUs, serving DSPs, serving wireless connectivity. All of these parts are now qualified in Lehi and shipping from Lehi. Not only you get more control shipping out of Utah versus Taiwan, the cost or the fall-through is tremendous. Think about what happened with wafer prices at the foundries in the last couple of years. The Lehi investment is predominantly done. The manpower was there when you took the team. The fall-through is almost a very real cost of a substrate and some gases and some electricity. So very beautiful transfer of revenue from foundry into inside TI, and allows us also to win more business with this dependability of capacity. Lehi, in essence, as it ramps to full production somewhere in 2025, will be simply revenue replacement. It doesn't need growth.
Okay.
To
How much revenue does Lehi support when it's at full capacity?
So I think it's close to $4 billion which is aligned, and it depends on the mix. It's going to start with embedded and later on had what we call high-speed mixed signal of analog. And this is what we do right now. So 45 nanometer this year and next year is analog. So when you complete that, more than $4 billion of revenue support, it's a very nice fall through. So that's point number one. The point number two that is going right now is RFab2.
Yes.
RFab2 is, again, a beautiful investment because the fabs are connected. So if you think about the way you add capacity.
RFab1 was the original one back from 2010 with the Comanda assets.
Correct. Okay. The cost to build RFab1 was much lower. Of course, we bought equipment 10 cents on the dollar. These days are over, and we can talk about why, but I think we all know why. And RFab2, we built the shell. I wish we had it earlier supporting the previous cycle, but it supports us right now. And the way it does it, it's as you add equipment into RFab2, wafers are traveling between the two fabs. So it's actually one big connected fab, which is a very efficient way to add modular way of adding equipment. But more important, even customers don't see it as a new factory, so I don't need to...
You don't have to requalify it.
No requalification, no change notification, it's the same factory. So that serves us very well, especially now, because Stacy, I'll be very frank, the part of the headwinds we experienced in 21, 22, we simply did not have enough capacity. Mm-hmm. And I was in the center of making some very tough decisions of who are the customers that are going to be told, hey, we have to find a different supplier. And it was very tough. I'm talking about a huge amount of revenue that we had to stay, not right now, mainly outside of industrial and automotive. So think about consumers, think about enterprise, some of the comms, and tough. But now, as RFab2 ramps, we go back to the sockets and we go and rewin. And it's a very, very effective way to do it, very low cost. And that's one of the ways that RFab2 right now is highly utilized.
Are you rewinning those sockets now?
We are. Yeah. And I think customers are smarter. I don't think we will be handed over 100% share, but let's start with 50 and work ourselves from there. So I think that is very, very important. And again, RFab2 is fully utilized these days.
Fully utilized.
It's not at full capacity because equipment is being added.
But equipment that's there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I say full, above 90%, okay.
And that supports another, what, 4 or 5 billion when it's full?
When it's fully built, it's going to be close to $6 billion, okay. And the other point, which is, again, now it's more tactical, but there is also transfer wafers to our fab. So this is the first time we do it. It's not simple, but we are transferring wafers from our 150 millimeter wafer fab that we announced. I think people don't remember that. $2 billion in Sherman, $2 billion a year kind of fab in Sherman in Dallas. One six inch fab.
Okay. I thought you closed all your 6-inch fab.
We haven't. But we are doing something very unique. Is modernizing these parts. So think about parts even from the Bear Brown days, pre-2000, getting redesigned into modern 300 millimeter wafers. So think about from 2,000 chips per wafer into 500,000. These are real cases. Cost becomes "quote unquote" close to zero. It stays with really packet and test costs. And the exciting part here is forget about the cost fall through. It's really the modernization of the part. Meaning, customers now have the peace of mind that I can run to the next 40 or 50 years. So they know that they are out of old factories and they can design them into future systems, especially at the lower cost that we are running in them right now. So I'm excited about that. That's another, again, when we talk about capacity, yes, there is a 30 billion, but these fabs are going to shut down. So this is also a tailwind that no one takes into effect. So what I'm excited about, and we build these factories during a downturn, revenue decline, because revenue is starting to stabilize and maybe starting to show momentum, having these two factories running at full capacity, one on the expense of the foundries, one on the expense of our 200. So underutilization in 200 and 150 may be growing, but our 300 millimeter wafer fabs are running at full. And I think
those ones are fully depreciated anyway, so 200.
Yeah, but there is still labor there, and there is underutilization associated with them. But That's hard work to utilize your best capacity or most modern capacity, especially as it prepares you for the future. I'm excited about it. I think people underestimate that. So, and you will see that fall through. You don't have to wait 15 years for that. Okay. That's coming now as we speak. So this is the phase one, you know, Alpha 2.
That's all phase one.
Phase one. Yeah. This is Alpha 1 and Alpha 2. Now, the more complex one is, let's talk about Alpha 2 and talk about Sherman, which is the heavy lifting in Texas. So Alpha 2, in my opinion, more straightforward. It's also on our slide. Large investment, our largest fab.
$11 billion?
Yeah, and we support probably more than that on revenue.
Oh, wow.
Sophisticated type of product compared to what we do. So running from 65 all the way to 28.
Do you have any products in 28?
We are developing them now. It's our own process, and the investment over there is tailored to our portfolio, mainly led by embedded, but also high-speed mixed signal for analog. And these will ramp sometime in it will ramp actually in Alpha, but will continue to ramp in Alpha 2. And Alpha 2, when we think about 2026, why we have 2026 as a milestone, this is when we are ready to receive tools.
For Alpha?
Yeah.
Okay.
Alpha 2 is a beautiful fab because it's connected. So we will add in a modular way tools as, you know, function of revenue. And we said, I think in the last capital management, we will decide capital beyond 2026 based on where revenue is first, what's your position, and then growth perspective.
Right.
So you said 10%-15%, so I disagree. It's
And that was
Those two lines.
That's on the slide, I think.
But it's a funnel. It's a funnel.
Yeah.
Okay. We also thought about, should we change the slide? We decided not to touch it, but I think you asked the question during that call. It can go from zero to.
Right. Depend, I mean, if revenues are growing 2% in 2027, I'm assuming that's going to be 50% of revenue.
Absolutely. And then you think about the fall through, it's immediate, right?
Yeah.
So that's just to clarify 2027 and beyond on that investment. Now, Sherman is a little bit more complex. And the reason is Sherman is what we call a new dot on the map. Luckily, the map is proximity to North Texas. It's only 30 miles away, but it's a new fab. And when you build a new clean room, and we are building two together because it's more efficient. We said on the call, equip Sherman 1, but what we say equip is really qualified because the capacity is going to be very small, less than, I think, less than $500 million of capacity in 2026. But you need to build it in order to not only qualify the fab.
Yeah.
You also have to get acceptance of your customers. So it's a long lead time type of approach. And that's how we think. You build the infrastructure so you can build into that clean room when the time comes. Same example as Alpha 2, but need some equipment in 2026. We are running there, Stacy, analog right now, copper and aluminum, 130-65.
Okay.
So it's a very sophisticated fab. The revenue output there.
That's the plan for Sherman right now?
Yeah. And revenue per fab is going to be close to $9 billion over there. And
There's going to be four fabs eventually.
Correct.
Right? $9
But again, you build according to revenue.
Yeah.
So the beauty of SM1, SM2, and again, they are connected. You can think about it about them as one large fab as you add capacity in a modular way based on revenue. So, just to go into more details about our plan and also to clarify the 2027 and beyond. Now, we said we finish it in 2026. We always try to execute at the best level. And, you know, it's within 2026. I don't have the exact month yet, but I think we should be done, some of them at the end of 2026, some of them earlier. So that will guide later on our capacity investment.
I guess if I add all of the incremental revenue, so we had Lehi, which was four, although maybe I don't know how much of it is incremental from where we are right now. It's somewhat utilized. Maybe it's two.
Lehi is not, don't think about Lehi as incremental revenue.
Okay. Okay. And then I guess same thing.
Lehi 1.
Alpha 2. So Lehi 2 is $11 billion. And then it sounds like Sherman, when it's done, is what, $36 billion, $9 billion a piece, you said?
That's what we talked about, 10-15 years, you know, but we'll build them as the revenue comes.
So the incremental revenue capacity growth between now and 2026 is primarily Lehi 2 then, is what you're suggesting?
No, it's zero from Lehi 2. Lehi 2, as we said.
The whole $11 billion is all.
By the end of 2026, it's clean room only. Okay.
Okay.
The $11 billion is for, of course, infra is for clean room and equipment.
Okay.
Mostly equipment.
Okay.
Equipment doesn't start before 2027.
Okay. So there's $5 billion a year in spending between now and 2026, but there's not a ton of incremental revenue capacity that's ready to go between now and 2026.
No, Alpha 2 is incremental revenue.
Okay.
Capacity. Of course, we are right now winning back sockets, but it gives you more capacity. So capacity for the company will grow. We mentioned, I think, supportability of $13 billion, but that's a sterile number. I think there is like mix, but never run at 100%. So, and I have a couple of pubs I need to shut down, okay?
Right.
So all of that gives you the picture of where we can be. And now let's talk about the revenue, Stacy, and I look at it peak to peak. So 2014, 2018, 2022, TI grew between every peak, every time, 21%, I think, 27%, and you named a year and the growth of maybe, let's take 2026 as an example, because it's exactly that four-year span. I don't think revenue is gonna be flat to 2022. Especially when I was compressed in 2022.
Okay.
And especially that-
How much revenue do you think you gave up or left on the table in, like, 2021 and 2022 because of the constraints you had?
Look, we have done that discussion internally. It's significant. It was concentrated on the three markets I've mentioned. It's significant.
'Cause it really is interesting. Like, if you actually look at the data over the last, like, four or five years, I mean, you clearly did lose share. I mean, do you think this is the primary reason? 'Cause it wasn't just NAND, it was analog, and it was embedded. If I just looked, like, strictly just at China as well, I'm sure we'll get to China, but everybody's worried about the Chinese taking share, and, like, broadly, the multinational analog players have been gaining share in China, except for you. Like, you've been losing share in China over the last several years, if you just look at the data. Do you think it was just all because of constraints, or do you think there was something else going on? And is anything changing there?
So again, first, as we like to talk about market share, you see there is, you know, we have forecasted Q2. I think revenue is building momentum. Let it play out, okay? And we are not done with this asynchronous process of inventory digestion. So, let's go through this. But I will say that it is a big part of the issue. I will say that the decisions how to select the customers in which you will have to take a step backwards, I mentioned the markets. And, you know, in China, we had some big customers on the consumer side, and we had to give up some of the sockets. But they see what we are doing right now, and they're willing to entertain us, and we are going to fight hard and get back on the board. So, that's the China comment, and I can talk more about China later. But to me, compression. The second point, and I was just about to say it on the how we peaked in 2022, and analog peaked in 2022, and but it actually peaked a year after middle of 2023. But if you think about the pricing move of Texas Instruments versus the competition, I listen to all the numbers, and I look at the, and you have to remove, you have to distinguish between ASPs and pricing. It's not always the same. There's just a ton of mix going on right now because of the asynchronous nature of the market. But if you look at if just to listen to what people did and also hearing it from our customers, I think we were the most customer-friendly. We haven't hiked the price to the level that people did, and that's part of the compression of the peak in 2022. That's my belief. This is why I give ourselves a good chance to form a new peak. And also the probability is very important, Stacy. How bad would it be to have the opportunity again in 2026 and not execute to it?
Yeah.
That would be devastating for the company, and we are not willing to let that happen.
Yeah. I mean, your inventory strategy flows into this as well, right?
Correct.
So I find it interesting that, you know, I wondered about. I know you guys were constrained, but at the same time, you were also building a ton of inventory, and you still are. And again, I'm not gonna knock. I understand why. I understand the whole idea that the lifetime of the product is really long, it doesn't go stale. Did you just build the wrong kind of inventory, like, at that point? Was it just hard to match what you built with where the-
You're talking about the beginning of COVID, maybe.
The beginning of, I mean-
So we built maybe-
You built a lot of inventory, and yet, like, anecdotally, a lot of the constraints were coming from TI, so.
No, look, so let's be fair. Maybe we've built a ton of inventory. I wish we had built two tons of it.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, that, so it was not the wrong inventory, it was the right one.
Not enough of it?
Not enough, because this is why we were flying high at the beginning of the upcycle, because we had the inventory.
Yeah.
We were unique there. We had products on the shelf.
You were the only ones that actually decided to keep running when COVID first. Everybody else shut down, it was a problem, right?
Correct. And, I don't think it was well received at the time, but all we wish right now, we had more, right? And that's what guides our current inventory investment, which, you know, it's the right part because we have the right data to know it's the right parts. And, we think it's gonna serve us very well, especially if the surge is, you know, is aggressive. So at least I want to prepare at least to similar historical surges. And Stacy, if you look at the, I know you look at units. If you look at the unit trend, forget about TI. Look at the market without memory.
Lousy.
We are below 2019 trough.
Right.
Is there more? Are there more sockets for every end equipment?
Yeah.
There are. How come we are lower than the trend line by so much?
I hear you. Like,
it's going to catch up. It always does.
Units for those who don't know, versus 2019 was the last industry downturn. 23 was a downturn. Non-memory revenues in 23 were down about 2% year over year. It wasn't a bad downturn, but revenues were down. Units were down almost 20. The only other worst year for year over unit growth was 2001.
Correct.
And units in 2020 were below the prior downturn 2019. ASPs were 30% higher for the industry, and ex-memory were up 45%. So, yes.
We studied the history as well. And by the way, we look at what in WSTS come with soon in a couple of days for April. But I will tell you that I think we're going to break a new record of peak to trough on units, even versus the year 2000, bubble crisis. So, to me, we have to prepare because that thing always catches up. No one believes it during the trough, but when you see it, it's too late.
So let's talk about that. So broadly, it's been a weird cycle, right? I mean, it's been very asynchronous, and we've had different end markets that have like peaked and troughed and leveled off and everything at different points. It does look like industrial has rolled over really, really hard. And I think peak to trough, for a lot of these guys, were down about 40% or whatever, peak to trough on revenue. And auto starting to roll. It's not collapsing, I wouldn't say, but it's starting to roll over. It does look like broadly for even you and most of your peers, people are calling Q2 as the bottom. And you talked about sort of hopeful signs of recovery. I think there's still some controversy over the shape and trajectory of that recovery. But like, what are you seeing in the near term? I'm looking into the second half and maybe into the beginning next year. Are we seeing actual signs of like robust recovery yet, or is it? I mean, people are arguing V-shaped or U-shaped or L-shaped or like, and I know you guys usually don't try to call a cycle.
Yeah.
And in this forum, I don't usually like to like drill a ton into short-term questions. But
yeah.
Especially if you're actually looking for a recovery and preparing for it, what are you seeing in terms of where that recovery might actually be starting now?
Look, the duration of the down cycle was long because of this asynchronous nature. I think you're right. And we just see a first in, first out behavior on everything. If you look at markets, call it PE first in, call it.
It's kind of stabilized for you guys.
There's down. I think now it gains momentum.
Yeah.
So it's driving growth. There is the year-over-year growth, and it's accelerating. And you see that. I believe. I mean, we'll have a good PE year in 2024. You think about the geographies. China first to the up cycle. China first to the down cycle. You know, are we seeing some signs in China that, you know, things can recover? Yeah, we mentioned PE, we mentioned us coming back and forth. You know, I think that's going to look better as we go. Industrial, to your point, the last one to together with automotive.
But
in a different level. So industrial, a very strong correction.
Yeah.
Over there, I don't think it's just inventory, overbuilding, and now digestion. I will say that automotive, I'm excited about. First, you know, revenue for TI, I mentioned 10 to 2013 to 2023, 10% growth for industrial and automotive. Auto is 15, which I believe is above market.
10% of your revenue is like 25 now.
It's actually 34 and
is
growing.
That how?
and growing. So and if you think about last year, grew 17%. If you think about Q1, it declined year over year for the first time at -2, so very low single digits. But I think we are seeing a very shallow trough. So, and I think it's related to two things. First, secular growth in automotive. Second, our position. I think our position is good. So I'm excited about automotive. I think we'll see momentum building sooner than later. So that's on the automotive side. Yes, you know, we've guided mid-single digit, I think, for Q2. I think in some areas, as I mentioned, like consumer and maybe enterprise and communication following. And I think industrial will be the last to correct, if that makes sense, because it declined more or less. The past sectors in industrial declined during the end of last year. Last point I will make on industrial, and you know it, hundreds of end equipment.
Yeah.
Not everyone is the same. You know, power tools and thermostats, call it appliances and building automation, are already looking to gain momentum. Factory automation, medical are still in the correction phase. So every end equipment has its own 2020. Now, you asked about when the market goes back up. When all these, and usually when I see a decline, I like to count to four quarters. When all these markets go through that 1 year of inventory correction, we are somewhere at the end of 2024 when it's done, I think. So you can think about, an opportunity moving forward.
Is it fair to say that, like, you guys clearly do a lot more in-house, and you have more control. Everything you're doing is you have more control over your own destiny, and but you don't have as much of a channel, you don't have as much of a buffer. Is it fair to say that what you're seeing is likely closer to what your end customers are actually seeing versus, like, having that buffer in between? Like, people look at you as you're the first to actually start to see the decline, right? Maybe for that reason. People wonder, like, is that a
No, I think it's a valid cause, and we can see it mainly when we go just in time to customers.
Yeah.
So not only we are direct, some of the customers work with consignment. So we build to a buffer, and they consume it real time. So I believe we can see real-time behavior of customers, and automotive is a great example. Most of our customer base is on consignment.
Yeah.
I think we get real-time signals. On the industrial side, there is a heavier reliance on the channel, on the distribution. Our footprint is not large.
Yeah. What's your distribution revenue mix? It's not that high anymore.
25% in 2023, Mike?
Yeah.
Yeah, so 25%. And yeah, it's probably gonna plateau around that 25%, maybe a little bit lower over time. But we also are excited about the investment in the other part of the dual channel, as we call it, which is our website, OTI.com, for e-commerce. That's something that we are modernizing. We like the investment we are making there.
What are your sales going through there, by the way? You gave some numbers on the cash a couple of years ago on the capital.
I mean, it did very well during the upturn because that's where customers went when they needed immediate availability. I think it stabilized to a lower level, but it's still a much more significant versus pre-COVID. So, and it's an established channel. We are making investments over there, and this is where data, information-
Yeah.
Can use bigger words, are gonna serve us in the future. We think this last mile, as we call it, is kind of messy in our industry, and why not modernizing it and take advantage of the IT developments in the world to serve our customers better? I think our customers expect that, and those who are getting on that modernized channel are excited about that.
Yeah. I guess it gives you, like, an early view to what customers are doing.
It's all real time. It's all real time, yeah.
So I do want to talk about China.
China, yeah.
So even beyond TI, like, a lot of investors, I mean, they see just a ton of capacity coming on in China. There's a lot of question, what's gonna go into those fabs? It's all lagging edge because they can't do leading edge. So people clearly worry about the potential for, like, local Chinese replacement, particularly analog and other lagging edge technologies. And I think you guys have, I don't know, 50% of your revenue goes into China, although I don't think that a lot of that's multinationals. What's the first, I guess, what's the local consumption in China? Do you have 20% or?
So I think you quoted a ship to number.
Yeah.
But think about-
No, that's what-
Think about our largest customer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's China, right?
Yeah, yeah, I get that.
So, I think we stopped reporting that because I think that's relevant. So we are now reporting, we are reporting, a headquartered in China revenue.
Okay.
The customer headquarters is in China.
Okay.
I think we finished Q1 at 17%, Mike.
Okay.
17%. It was higher during COVID, but also, as I said, China was first into the down cycle, and I think it's probably gonna be usually it's first in, first out, so we'll see that. And just on the China side,
Sure.
You know, let's put things in perspective about capacity. China is about 17%-20% of world GDP. So for me, the market opportunity is kind of correlated to GDP. I think it is correlated to GDP. But it's still a very important viable market that we want to compete at, and they have enough capacity to serve them and more, okay? Because their buildup of fab and not, I think, for China only. They have ambitions to get into R&D, think about big parts sitting in our servers, in our medical equipment, in EVs. I'm not sure. I'm not excited about it. I'm sure, I'm not sure the U.S. government is excited about it. I know that my customers are excited about it. So this is where this geopolitically dependable capacity-
Yeah.
Is coming and taking a big role on the future of Chinese, and I think it's very, very important to the parameter of how customers make decisions. So that capacity, again, we compete, we see in China, for China mainly. We see a tough set of competitors, all fabless, or predominantly fabless, and we compete. You know, luckily, the set of competitive advantages that we've built over the years, the technology and manufacturing, as you said, relying on ourselves, cost advantage, the breadth of the portfolio, which is very unique versus the set of competitors in China. The channel advantage, the reach, ability to touch so many customers, some of them very small, that the local players don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
And last but not least, the position we've built in industrial and automotive. It's very similar in China. Also, close to 80% of our revenue in China is on industrial and automotive. I give ourselves a good chance to compete, but it is becoming more competitive. And that's what's going on from a high level over there.
Do you think the pricing trends in China are different from what you've seen elsewhere in the world? Like, do you compete harder in China versus where you have to compete elsewhere?
I do, because I think the local or the emerging competition in China is highly accepted in China. So, and, you know, I think TI can gain premium over there because we have the breadth, we have the quality, we've been a trusted supplier for many years, especially in industrial and automotive. There is a moat around this type of market. But, you know, these guys are capable, and I don't want my team to think they can do only very simple parts, because I've seen these people building more and more complex set of solutions. And we need to compete across the board, most on the catalog type of more general purpose parts, but also on the application specific, where AUP is higher. And of course, the market price is set by them, but it's not a walk-away market price for us, simply because we have the cost competitiveness to play that game.
I guess to touch on that concept of geopolitical dependable capacity, how important is the CHIPS Act for you? Like, if it wasn't for the CHIPS Act, would you be pursuing the same CapEx strategy that you're pursuing right now?
Yeah, I think we talked about it last year. And look, every time you make an investment, you look at the probabilities and affordability, and it's always a set of parameters. And we were very clear that we decided to increase our investment lean on capacity because we got some help, or also because we got some help from CHIPS Act. So I think we had a plan at the beginning, hey, let's build for a lower level of revenue opportunity. Oh. And we said, hey, let's take it a step up because we are getting help. Unfortunately, I cannot communicate where we are because we are not done yet. So we have submitted the application. Of course, the ITC is helping, but beyond the ITC, there is a...
The ITC is actually bigger, right?
It's expected to be bigger. We have 25% of your investment in the U.S. But, you know, the grants are also important.
Yeah.
And we are waiting to see where does that land.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've submitted it end of last year, and we should hear, I believe, in the coming month where we landed. So this is definitely helping, but compare that to what China does for their industry, you know, health is important for us to compete versus SMHC and other players.
Got it. I want to ask about a couple of the growth markets that my clients are clearly in. So how much EV exposure does TI have? Because I was, it's not really a joke. I was saying you're as happy to sell like the headlight controller in a car as you are anything else, right? I mean, it doesn't seem to be, you're just playing the general content trend, but like, how do we think about EVs and their impact on technology?
First, let me just, I don't know if it's correction or clarification, but
correct or clarify anything I say.
Automotive, from a very complex ADAS processor, tens of dollars, all the way to lighting controllers.
Uh-huh.
So we don't like to brag about radar solutions at 77 gigahertz right now, but or SPD Link, high-speed connectivity that runs at hundreds of millions a year, and OBC controller for onboard charger with our DSP solutions. But we ship them, and we ship them at a high volume. But we also ship, as you said, a bunch of catalog parts for automotive that we are very proud of, and they all add up to a very significant opportunity in automotive. So automotive, I think right now in Q1 was the size of industrial already. They ran at the same level.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the breadth of the opportunity is only growing. Now, if you go to EV, more than 2x, Stacy. When you look at our exposure and our opportunity on versus EV.
How much of your auto revenue today is EV? I don't know if there's going to be overlap. I'm assuming
I don't have that right now in front of me. That you can check that. But it's significant. And the beauty of it, EVs are not fully... run their S-curve adoption, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is room to grow over there. But as I talked about the last decade, it was mainly on ICE. And I think about the future 10 years, it's mainly on a mix of ICE and EVs.
You think your content opportunity in EV is 2x, you said?
Our opportunity on EV, and we've done that math.
Yeah.
We kind of look at the dollar opportunity is more than $1,000, and it's
That's the opportunity. How much TI? What's the average TI content in an average car, do you-
Oh, today, we are shipping hundreds of dollars, you know, in some cases close to $1,000, in some cases lower, but very high content. It depends also on the-
Yeah
How many cameras, how many screens.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on the vehicle tier. But if you look at the high tiers, well above $500 per vehicle.
Got it. Got it. And then I'd be remiss, I don't know if you want to hear it or not, but I have to ask about AI. Like, so is there-
Yeah.
Is there an AI play for TI? Like, where do you guys benefit from that?
Yeah, a growing opportunity.
Okay.
So, let's say the biggest one I'm excited about is, you know, think about cloud and servers and the compute guys, that they are starting to power in levels that I couldn't imagine, you know, above 1,000 amps and going into a processor. And, you know, you start to see, you know, close to a kilowatt and higher. And if you look at our roadmap, it just wants to be higher, right? So the way you serve that is what we call a multi-phase control solution. Many, many parts going and serving this processor. So I'm excited about this. This is where Sherman One comes into play, because this is our newest technology.
What node does Sherman go down to, by the way?
At 65 nanometer.
Okay.
We think we are building the best PCB process on Earth. And, in terms of the opportunity to serve a very fast-growing market from the U.S. again, because you want these PMIC parts to come from a dependable source, I see a growing opportunity. The product portfolio is there. We are talking with all the big ones, and I'm excited about the progress. We're also gaining share platform to platform, but I think we are still kind of only scratching the surface. Close, I think at the peak, it ran. I actually looked at it lately, close to a billion-dollar business. If you look at datacom in the server and also power, but power is the biggest one. Okay? So that's on AI. The second part, and, you know, maybe I should have mentioned it even last year when you asked me the question, think about the edge. We have a good, low-power processing business. Think about our DSP days. You know, think about neural networks and deep learning. These are all matrix manipulation. We have very good accelerators that we've developed over the years. They sit in our processors, and when you think about inference, TI is there. DMS, or driving monitoring systems, we have a leading solution, winning at many, many OEMs, and that is using that machine learning accelerator. Think about even, you know, go to arc detection in you know, energy infrastructure. TI's DSPs are solving that problem as well. So AI at the edge for inference is a growing opportunity for the company, and we have early wins. The last one, early, but robotics or content per robot for the company is significant. Tens of microcontrollers. Some of them with machine vision capabilities. So that is still. Think about, you know, the humanoids or human robotics. They have a lot of content for,
That's going to be a thing, humanoid robots?
I know that there is a lot of content per robot. I just know how to serve the end equipment.
Okay.
Calling out how many units will be sold in the future, I was never good enough to guess that. But winning the socket is where we are busy.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to ask a little bit more about, like, industry structures, particularly on M&A. So, like, TI has not really participated in, like, large-scale M&A for quite a while. Like, you've had some competitors who have, and I'd argue, have been fairly successful at it. What are your thoughts on that? Is there anything, I guess, you need, like, have your priorities on what you would be looking for if you were looking for deals, have those changed at all over the years, or is that what kind of kept you out of it?
Look, I think this is nothing has changed there. We are always looking. It's, we always said it's gonna be analog-centric. We always look at, hey, is there a technology that can complement our portfolio? We don't have a, you know, a lot there when we look at it. Even, you know, just take an example of wide bandgap technology. Again, we are investing this in internally. So I think we many times prefer the make versus the buy opportunity. But, you know, depending on the right time, and also we need to think about affordability. Right now, we are so busy in getting ahead on our capacity and getting back to that free cash flow per share trend line, as we mentioned. that's a priority right now. But as we go back to the trend, you know, maybe opportunities will pop up and, you know, TI will make a move. But at least what I like about our position right now, there is nothing that we really need to build a scale and to set the future for the company.
I guess to talk about that free cash flow per trend.
Yeah.
Free cash flow per share trend.
Yeah.
Do you have a number in mind? I know you've given, like, sort of revenue capacity, like, kind of numbers. And to go back to the Elliott letter, I know they were throwing out $9, or I think it was $11.27. And I presume you guys have done the math on, hey, if we cut our CapEx in half, the free cash flow per share goes up. But do you have some idea of, like, what that free cash flow per share trend ought to get you in 2026 or 2027 or 2030, or, like, whatever it is? Like, what are we shooting for here?
Yeah, I thought we were very. I think we had a slide in capital management, right?
That's why I'm asking. I can't remember what the number was.
Okay. It's 12 in 2026. It's 13.3 in 2027. Not that I remember. Okay, but that's the trend line. That's the trend line.
That was not a target. That was the trend.
No, but
Okay.
Good. The trend line is there. I think Mike said or Dave said it, this is what guides us. And that trend line, we haven't shown a trend line of 15 years, basically.
Yeah.
Okay? Not that I'm picking on you, 15 years, but, you know, we showed 2004, I think, through 2022, and they extrapolated that trend line through 2030. So when I think about when you get back, it's within that time frame, and I don't have 2030 in my brain, okay? I see the modular capacity plan coming in play as soon as, you know, back end of 2026 into 2027. And that's the expectation. I mean, that's the expectation from the team. Of course, revenue has to do something during that time. But even if revenue wants to be very poor, then what do you do with CapEx? You're done. Okay? You let it fall through, and then it will fall through very nicely. So we have run all kind of scenarios over there. I'm excited about it, and the beauty of where we are, I don't think you have to wait two or three cycles to get that to come into play. So we are, I think, marching into the next cycle. It's the first time we have predicted or guided for sequential growth after 2 years, I think. 2 years of decline.
You actually been down eight quarters in a row?
Seven, maybe. Yeah, something like that. But guided it, guided the first time out for maybe 2 years. And it's easier to invest when you have revenue momentum on your side. So I think that's what Mike said. When I compare Fittier a year ago, I see markets joining the inventory digestion, and I think a big part of it is behind us. There is a momentum building on revenue, the factories that we are operating, so producing chips at a wonderful cost, wonderful alternative cost. And as revenue grows, I think that investment will come to fruition very quickly. So I'm super excited about that space.
Got it. Got it. That makes sense. Look, we've got about a minute and a half left.
Yeah.
You've kind of been doing it, but I'll give you your soapbox. Why should investors buy TI stock today?
Okay. First, I think, and again, the investment, yes, we make investment, thinking like long-term owners. When I think about long term, it's 10 years or 15 years, but you don't need to wait 10 years or 15 years, for this investment to come to fruition. We are a very unique supplier, in terms of have a combination of enough capacity, the cost competitive or affordable, position, and very dependable. And as customers care more and more about it, and as revenue starts to build momentum again after a very tough cycle, I think the company could not be in better shape than it is today. I'm excited about the future, and I'm excited for us and for all of our shareholders. So that would be my short pitch.
I think that's as great a place to leave it as any. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stacy. Thank you.
Appreciate it.